Welcome to episode 90 of the Infectious Historians Podcast. I'm Merle.
And I'm Lee.
It's April 21st, 2022. So happy Passover to you, Lee. And in today's episode, we're going to talk about public health and specifically public health laboratories and how they have developed and changed across the last half century or so. To do so, we're going to have two guests today, which we haven't done in a while, Lee. So I'm excited to get back to that format. Our guests are Klaas Kirchheil and Samantha Vanderslot. Klaas is an assistant professor at the University College Dublin in Ireland. He's worked widely on a number of topics, but specializes in the history of microbes, laboratory infrastructures, and the development of antibiotics and vaccines. He's published three books: Pyrrhic Progress, The History of Antibiotics in Anglo-American Food Production, Bearing Witness, Ruth Harrison, and British Farm Animal Welfare, and the forthcoming Typhoid, The Past, Present, and Future of an Ancient Disease. He's also working on projects on lab networks and disease surveillance, vaccine trials, and antibiotic innovations. And he's also done quite a bit of public outreach on this work. So hi, Klaas, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And our second guest is Samantha Vanderslot, who is a university research lecturer at the Oxford Vaccine Group, who's working on health, society, and policy topics. She's published a book last year on attention and responsibility in global health, The Currency of Neglect, and is coming out this year is supporting vaccination, activism, petitions, and clinical trials, and the aforementioned Typhoid, The Past, Present, and Future of an Ancient Disease. At the moment, she is researching public attitudes and decisions on vaccination, along with public policy and media representation of vaccination across countries and historically. So welcome, Samantha.
Hi, Merle. Hi, Lee. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, so I thought this would be a good episode, Lee, to discuss something I've been thinking a lot about recently, which are structural issues about public health and public health labs, and how, while you and I have obviously thought about emerging infectious diseases and the quote-unquote next pandemic and how it was quote-unquote inevitable, it seems that perhaps this hasn't caught on as widely, perhaps in the public. And public health labs seem like a good way to talk about how maybe big events like your favorite book, and I believe your daughter's favorite book, Lee, The Hot Zone by Richard Preston, have or haven't changed structural ideas about public health and emerging infectious diseases.
Yes, The Hot Zone has come up on several of our past episodes, but I think that this episode actually does follow on some of the other previous episodes that we've had that look at things from this broader public health perspective. And I think we've covered topics in the past, such as the episodes on some of the bigger names on these matters, such as the episode we had on Joshua Lederberg or the episodes on COVID policy. But I think the labs running behind the scenes is a level of public health that we haven't really discussed in the past. So I'm looking forward to doing that in this episode. Before we move on to that, Merle, how have you been since we last recorded in person a few weeks ago?
Yeah, so I definitely thought I had finally gotten COVID. I had chills, I had sweats, which is not normal for me with a cold. I usually just get lots of nose fun stuff. But I did two rapids and a PCR, and my daughter did two rapids and a PCR because she had a bit of a runny nose as well. And all six of those were negative. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's probably just the head cold.
So is that kind of overkill with tests? Is that normal? So do you usually test like three tests just to make sure?
Sometimes we have all the rapids on hand because my wife, who's, you know, the greatest planner known to humankind, went out before the Omicron wave and just basically stocked up on rapid tests. So we had, I think, 20 boxes at one point of rapid tests at home so we could go through those. And PCRs are actually relatively easy to get here as long as they're drive-through. You could just do them same day now because I think no one's trying to test. But on a positive note, on Monday, we actually went to the White House Easter egg rollie. Are you familiar with that event?
Not really. No, tell us all about it.
So they do a whole bunch of activities annually for kids. Obviously, they haven't done it since COVID. And you come in and there's an Easter egg roll where you roll eggs down the White House lawn. And there's food all made out of, you know, various types of egg products. There's an Easter egg hunt. There's crafting activities. There's various, you know, people dressed up as favorite characters and this kind of stuff. So it's actually quite an exclusive hard ticket to get. at the White House, and my kids were the perfect age because they're 4 and a half. And so they loved, you know, doing all the Easter egg rolls and stuff. I should send you photos of this. It's quite lovely. And you do it and take nice photos like right in front of the White House lawn. So you feel, you know, very powerful and special.
Yes, that sounds great. No, please do. Maybe we can upload those images to the website. Rolls children's pastimes.
Sounds like a good plan. Maybe a divergence from what this episode and this podcast is supposed to be about. But good lighthearted humor is always nice. But what about you, Lee? How's your Passover going? I know the Israeli Passover is easier because it's shorter and you can kind of eat almost whatever you want compared to the Ashkenazi version.
Well, yes and no. I've been thinking, you know, this is like the third Passover we've had on this podcast. So I think the first one, we started the podcast during or right before Passover 2 years ago. So it is kind of like another milestone. As for Passover here, I guess it is somewhat easier than in the United States. There are a lot of ways to replace any bread or grain really related items here. They tend to be much more expensive than I remember. That I remember it from my time in the United States. But I mean it's not that big of an issue, I would say. Bigger issue for me is that over the past day or so, both my daughter and my dog have probably caught a virus. The question is whether it's the same virus or not. They had some very similar symptoms, so both of them have been throwing up a lot. That's been interesting, to put it that way. But yeah, other than that, we are on vacation for about a week in the middle of the semester. So other than this past day, things are relatively good.
So what about you, Sam? Where are you? Are you in Oxford? Or are you somewhere else off gallivanting due to the middle of the term or just because you can?
Yes. Yeah, so I've actually just been on holiday, also celebrating Passover with my in-laws. And this has been the first one since the pandemic that we've been able to be together. So that's been really nice. Last year, I think, because I had long COVID, I was actually physically in the same place as them, but couldn't come up to the dinner table. So watched everyone eating their nice foods and celebrating upstairs. And I was stuck in bed, which wasn't so much fun, but I'm glad to be better this year. And then I think the year before was, yeah, complete lockdown. So yeah, it's been quite a celebratory year for me.
How is long COVID? I mean, I think we've had a couple of guests with that, but it's, as far as I understand, the symptoms are supposed to be very different between people.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm sorry to class. I'm going to bore him with my symptoms because normally I do an update and talk about how we're doing and it would be kind of the same thing with me for such a long time. And I've only just come out the other end, really. And mine has mainly been fatigue and like a hangover feeling with really bad headaches. So I just kind of woke up every day with this headache, which almost wasn't bad enough to stop working. I was doing kind of carrying on as normal, but it did limit my capacity to really get on with things. And I think being a bit stressed and trying to get back to normal again didn't really help. So you can't just get back into exercise, get back into seeing people, because that seemed to string it along even more. But I'm through the other end, I think, but who knows with this strange disease.
Did you have like the COVID symptoms?
I had the typical COVID symptoms, but I would say I wasn't a very bad case. I didn't have to go to hospital. I was just kind of ill for about 3 weeks to a month with the fever, with a bit of a bad throat, feeling unwell. And then about 4 months later, I got shingles and started feeling really bad. I got vaccinated. I actually felt worse afterwards. I was hoping I'd feel better. And then it's kind of come in a recurrent cycle where every 4 months I'd feel a bit worse again, be a bit more under, have to stay more in bed. And now it's slowly spaced out a bit. And the last vaccine I had, I didn't really have many bad effects. And yeah, I think I'm pretty much back to normal now. So fingers crossed.
That's really good to hear that things are looking up. What about you, Klaas? Are you in Ireland? I think you'd be our second guest in Ireland that we've had on the podcast, if that's the case, or have you gallivanted off as well?
So at the moment, I'm speaking to you from the south of France, which is, I think, weather-wise, a bit nicer than Ireland, and from Lyon specifically, where my wife actually has a position at the UNS here. So yeah, I think our Easter with two small kids at home, it's always less restful, the holidays, than they used to be. That's been kind of like the main refrain. But otherwise, it's been a nice little break. Thankfully, the last 2 years for us have been, we hope, free of COVID. We may have had it right at the beginning, but there were no tests available at that point. But yeah, it's been a real challenge, I think, for us, primarily just in terms of having children and mastering all of the lockdowns and trying to have them retain a normal sense of life, I think, despite all of the madness.
Has your childcare situation been stable, or has it constantly been shut down? I know mine has versus Lee. They just don't believe in COVID, as far as I can tell, at the childcare level.
It was a real up and down ride. I mean, I was living in the UK when COVID hit, so the UK response is now universally acknowledged, the initial response, to have been quite a bit of a disaster. So we were locked down, we were self-isolating initially, and then the whole country locked down. So we were at home with our daughter at that time through, I think, historically bad timing. We were expecting our second child in October 2020. So also going through a pregnancy during 2020 had its own challenges, including not being able to go to the healthcare settings. Obviously, the anxiety about what would happen, should we actually contract COVID, et cetera. So it was a really emotionally challenging time. I was very fortunate at the beginning of 2020 to have secured my Wellcome Trust grant. So at least I didn't have to worry about teaching to the same extent. I was on research leave, so that gave me a bit more flexibility. But yeah, 2020 was essentially being locked up with a small kid and then two small kids, and kind of navigating outputs and writing in the night.
All of that sounds very familiar to me. And I don't know how I personally survived. So congrats to you for surviving.
For me, it's just blank. I mean, my daughter was born just before COVID. So she was born February 2020. And yeah, that first half year, I remember nothing. I mean, I taught, raised her, apparently did research, started this podcast, but I don't remember like how I felt. I probably had nothing else to do.
Isn't that the definition of trauma?
Yeah, you said that.
As I told you, Lee, you don't remember the first 6 months of your kid's life anyway, so it's a wash one way or the other.
So you're saying I'm actually been fortunate enough. Okay, that's another way to look at it.
That's how you create nostalgia, Lee.
Okay, so to pivot here from Rolla's nostalgia to the interview itself. So we tend to start off with this very broad, open-ended question, maybe even a bit tricky question, but I guess the way to start this interview is maybe to ask you, how do public health laboratories work and what exactly do they do?
It's a huge question. And the historian's answer is their role varies across different countries depending on their role. So that's the boring answer. The right answer, according to the technical definition, is that in contrast to a private clinical laboratory, what a public health laboratory really focuses on is testing and disease monitoring for broader groups of the population. And this can be baseline routine testing for example, STDs, that's a kind of classic original public health role, or TB testing, for example. But it can also involve the role out of specific testing protocols for specific diseases that are confined to one locality. In the case of COVID, obviously, we've seen the big COVID testing situation where lots of public and private laboratories have taken up public health roles. But I think key to what the public health laboratory really does is that it is an official or semi-official institution that then transmits that data in modern systems to a centralized epidemiological surveillance system in nation states, which enables a nation state or a transnational organization, or, you know, whatever you want it really to be, to survey the presence of disease and the health within a population, and then, you know, structure specific interventions.
So that's a pretty broad range of things. And I imagine that, you know, there's some scientists and lab coats working in these places, but who else works there, right? I mean, aside from kind of stereotypical image that popped into my head when you said that.
It's, again, depending on the role of the public health laboratory in the countries, you'll have a wide range of specialties there. You'll have, obviously, scientists. There's also lots of research carried out in public health laboratories, especially in national public health laboratories, which are, you know, often sentinel laboratories. But you also have a huge array of different technical specialties, ranging from laboratory technicians to people who are experts in culturing and preserving strains. And in many public health laboratories, traditionally, you also had healthcare specialists directly embedded in the laboratory too. So you'd have kind of a broader public health institute where you'd have a laboratory, and the laboratory was plugged into, say, a medical officer of health who had epidemiological expertise. In some cases, that person would also then be in charge of doctors working in schools. Some countries have dentists or ophthalmologists embedded in the public health laboratory or kind of public health office context. So it really, again, depends on the country, but you can really see it as a kind of hub of microbiological processing that's plugged into the broader public health work of a community.
So you mentioned, I think, a couple of times already, the variability or variance between countries and with regards to their public health laboratories. How different are different countries' public health laboratories and infrastructure more broadly? I mean, is it mostly kind of like the same, or do we see like vast differences depending on wealth or even historical practices and development and so on?
I think that's a super important question. And I think that's one of the things that often gets glossed over when we talk about, for example, the global response to COVID-19. I mean, I think at the baseline, probably the most important difference across different contexts is economic wealth. Public health laboratories cost money. And as a consequence, if you move to the, you know, for want of a better word, global north, you'll have denser coverage, much more sophisticated equipment and much more personnel working for them than in low-income areas with weak structural support systems. So that's a key difference across the kind of globe. But even within the global north, you'll have very different systems that have evolved over a century now to meet different political contexts and also to meet different constitutional settings and also in response to historical phenomena in which public health was tied into in different national histories. So there is a broad range of public health laboratory systems, both in terms of political variation, but also in terms of simply economic resources and also politically stable structures into which they can be plugged into.
So as a follow-up there, what would be the most important variables to keep in mind here, right? So you mentioned wealth as maybe the most important variable, but what would the other ones be? Maybe like centralization or decentralization, or what other variables are we talking about here?
So if we just look at the global north in this context, I think you've already prompted me to kind of answer, yeah. So a key variable is really the degree of centralization of public health laboratory networks. So the way it's obviously a public health laboratory is most effective if it works in tandem with many other laboratories throughout the communities and is tied into some kind of system that makes sense of the data and then allows you to inform a response going forward. And different nations have come up with different solutions to that. In my work, I focus specifically on Germany, the UK, and the US, but there's also a broad range of other systems there. But the kind of key difference, for example, if you compare the US system to the UK system, would be that in the US, public health laboratories still remain part of the state's responsibilities of an individual state within the United States. So each state has responsibility for public health laboratory coverage. So it's a fairly actually decentralized system with a kind of centralized service provider in the form of the CDC plugged in on top of that to coordinate these responses. And that's often something that's not really discussed when we talk about US public health responses, where you assume an all-powerful CDC at the top, which it really isn't, constitutionally speaking. It's a service provider in many ways. And that's how it was originally conceived for public health duties at the state level. And this contrasts a lot with, for example, how the British system evolved after the Second World War and during the Second World War, where a public health laboratory system was really kind of created as a nationally integrated, highly centralized system of laboratories capable of reacting to bacteriological warfare. And also then after the war, capable of catering to the demands of an increasingly centralized British welfare state going forward. So the structure here is defined in many ways by broader political, cultural decisions about how a nation perceives how its periphery is plugged into the center when it comes to decision making.
I think also the focus has been on the lab itself, when Klaus has alluded to that there's this wider network, and that's including people working within the community and other healthcare structures. So it's not just thinking about the scientists who are doing the work in the laboratory. It's also people collecting samples. It's the governance and the policy work that's going on. It's the stats and the epidemiologists who aren't based normally in those centres. So really the arms go further than our idea and picture in our mind of what those public health laboratories look like.
Can I ask you then, Samantha, you know, Klaus just laid out kind of the broad difference, say, between the US and the UK. Do any of those structures change significantly over the last, say, 50, 75 years in terms of development? Is there any way of, you know, turning the ship, so to speak, to make the US more centralized or to make the UK more decentralized or something like that?
So the names have changed quite a bit. This is really also Klaus's area, so I'll let him follow on. But we have seen really a move from having labs go across the country to wanting to be supposedly more efficient and cutting down the number of labs that we have in the UK, which then caused problems during COVID. And then we went to the model of having these lighthouse laboratories, where it was almost going back to an older model of having more labs, but bigger ones. So that was quite a big difference during COVID. But Klaus, this is the work you've been doing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can come in and kind of flesh that out with a kind of broader perspective, I guess. I would say one of the biggest changes that we've seen over the past 70, 80 years in the way nations conceive of their public health laboratory systems is that initially they do arise fairly decentralized in all of the nations. But then during the 30s and 40s, really wherever you look, there is this focus on providing local coverage with public health laboratories. So there is a microbiologist who can be reached either in a hospital or somewhere else in the community, sometimes, but not always, working in tandem with an epidemiologist and doctor, but, you know, really rooted in the local center, reporting back often to a national center. But, you know, there is this presence there. And then from the 60s and 70s onwards, as a result of, I would say, the declining importance of infectious diseases in public policy planning, but also new ideals of how a state should function in terms of providing lean services, there's this new ideal of epidemic intelligence, which gains currency on both sides of the Atlantic. And key to that, and it's initially a very useful concept, is that all of this data should be streamlined in the center, it should be made sense of centrally, and then it can allow you to create rapid responses. But it almost then starts functioning as a stand-in, as an excuse to cut down on the provision of local services and focusing more resources onto the center. So what we see, for example, in the UK and the US, is this real rise in prominence of centers in Atlanta or of Colindale in London, but a relative decline of, you know, this kind of hinterland capacity of public health laboratory coverage at the local level, at the state level, or in the UK, for example, in the peripheries, with the UK North once again being underserved, for example, in comparison to the UK South. And that's a real shift in terms of how public health laboratory coverage is conceptualized. And it gathers steam on both sides with neoliberalism, with cost-cutting pressures going forward, where every cut is almost justified with a focus on a leaner, meaner, more integrated public health service, relying on IT, relying on centralized epidemiological modeling going forward. And I think with COVID, we saw a kind of nadir of the capacity of that service to actually react to a challenge which can't be stamped out quickly, but actually something that becomes, there's been a lot of criticism of this word, endemic within the community. It's where the centers of excellence are overwhelmed. And what Sam's referred to in the UK context is super interesting. I mean, this attempt to rebuild capacity with the help of privatization and, you know, huge laboratories built from the ground up overnight. Unfortunately, however, once again, they aren't really embedded in the communities either, right? These are centralized data machines that produce data literally, I mean, they're not culturing, they're producing data from the sequencing, and they actually aren't plugged into local public health services either. So I think we're at this moment of a big reorientation of how we should structure public health going forward.
The lighthouse description does seem to be quite apt here, because they are standing alone, unconnected, but these kind of huge structures that got in lots of capacity, kind of lots of goodwill, I think, as well. So all these scientists and researchers, people doing PhDs who put everything on hold to come in and help build capacity and do what is quite a technical job, and from descriptions also maybe quite a boring one, but they felt it was very important and we did need this to happen. But they've remained unembedded in the wider machinery for health in the UK.
And what's super interesting, both in the UK and US context, is it's not really the state who necessarily constructed those. In the UK, it was outsourced to contractors like Zerko, who suddenly built these lighthouse facilities. And in the US, obviously, there was also a massive outsourcing of mass testing to the private sector, similar to Germany. So I would say, yeah, I mean, yeah, we've definitely increased testing capacity, but we certainly aren't returning to the 1930s, 1940s, where you've got this public institution rooted in your local community. This is the market. And I would personally argue that that makes long-term capacity building a lot more difficult than rerouting public funds into public communities.
If I may take us a bit backwards in this discussion. So when we say public health laboratories, I mean, where would these institutions be housed, right? Would they be part of universities, for example? Would they be part of hospitals? Would they be standalone institutions with offices or labs actually somewhere within a city or so on?
There's a broad range, as I already said initially, of different locations of public health laboratories. Some were standalone, so they were really conceived of as a standalone public health laboratory. But in the US specifically, lots of universities initially generate extra funding through providing public health laboratory services through university labs. In the UK, there's a long tradition of having public health laboratories embedded in hospitals. There's a big advantage of having the clinician talk to the public health doctor who knows what's happening in the community and then can tie it into the hospitals. In Germany, there was a long tradition of having them embedded into so-called Gesundheitsämter, so public health offices, which were distinct in different states around the country. So there's a big diversity of where they are located in general, but over time, what happens in nearly every single national context is that these kind of sentinel laboratories, these specialist laboratories in national centers or in regional centers do rise in prominence because it's quite expensive to provide specialist reference services. So if you're dealing with a rare pathogen, for example, it doesn't make sense to have every laboratory in the country able to deal with it. You want to have a specialist who can offer these services. And that happens from the 40s, 50s, 60s onwards that we see places like Atlanta or Colindale, or in Germany, the Robert Koch, for example, become increasingly prominent as a kind of center of excellence.
You mentioned privatization of a lot of these services, and this obviously brings to mind COVID and my own personal COVID testing experience, which, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, the best way to do this is, say, drive through at a pharmacy, or actually even better is one of those 24-hour pediatric places, because if you have kids, you can get them basically PCR tested in like 8 hours at a specialty place. So how does that work in terms of, obviously, that's a private sector doing stuff. They're getting somehow a cut of all this. But it is, quote unquote, more efficient in terms of speed, at least for my kids' PCR. So how do those two things kind of work together? I mean, could we build up a public health capacity and make this better and it could be fast for everyone? Is that a possibility, or is this something that's always going to be in tension?
I think the ability to open up these contracts and also end them quite quickly has been really appealing to the government. So it doesn't seem that likely that we're going to be building any kind of infrastructure that looks similar to what we might have had in the past, or the public sector trying to mimic what the private sector is doing. It doesn't look like that's going to be happening from our experience during COVID.
Yeah, I would add to it that there's a kind of twofold answer there. I would say it's wrong to think of private laboratories necessarily in opposition to public health laboratories, either in the present or in history. In the US, there's a super long tradition of commercial laboratories and test providers existing in tandem with public health laboratories. It's a big struggle for the kind of state to standardize testing practices. And that's actually one of the early triumphs of the CDC, is in asserting its authority over these private testing laboratories for standards. But they do provide surge capacity, and they do provide extra capacity in different states who might not invest in their physical capacity. In the UK, it's an interesting thing because they essentially wiped out private testing with the founding of the Public Health Laboratory Service and the NHS in the 40s and 50s. So there was significant testing capacity on the ground through public test providers at that point. That has, over the decades, been whittled down to an extent where the surge capacity of the Public Health England, was then called at the beginning of the capacity, was so limited that I think they could only do 500 tests a day nationally when COVID hit. And that was obviously completely insufficient, whereas Germany's response, in an interesting kind of counter-narrative, rested on the ability of combining its public testing capacity with a law that was passed very early on, whereby insurers could compensate commercial laboratories for the private testing capacity. So that allowed them to build massive surge capacity without necessarily stripping the public infrastructure of its capacity, but, you know, having that kind of add-on capacity, which can then fall away when you don't need it anymore with the market readjusting. So if we think about efficiency, I think it depends on how we define it, right? If we want to have public efficiency of public funds, it might not be the most efficient approach to just rely on the market for surge capacity, invest tons of money, and then see that kind of wash away when the pandemic waves have passed. But the market does play a very important role historically in nearly all of these analyzed countries in compensating, or complementing, I should say, the public system for things that it just doesn't want to provide or can't provide at speed.
So in countries where the private sector does join in and complement the public efforts, there is some kind of conflict of interest here, right? I mean, how separate is the data, for example, right? So if it's a private company who's using data coming out of really what is supposed to be public testing or as a service that the state is supposed to provide to its citizens, do they keep that data, for example, separate, or do they record it and can use it as just like a byproduct or something and make use of it either in within that specific company or maybe even sell that data on another market?
There have been some ongoing issues about how data is used. And I actually wanted to just pick up also what Klaas was saying about the public and private, because I think that's really important that we've witnessed a real blending of public and private during COVID. And we've almost not thought about it in a way that has stricken people as being quite unusual. It's almost become the norm, I think. And I just want to refer to vaccination services and thinking about me getting my last vaccine. I almost had a bit of a Twilight Zone moment because I went and got it in my hometown in Basingstoke while I was visiting my mum, and it was in the local mall. So a shop had been converted into a little NHS hub. And I just thought, wow, can you imagine 3 years ago, I would be going to get a vaccine during a global pandemic in what would normally be somewhere that Zara or some other shop would be held, and those shops have moved out and there's empty spaces and it's being filled by a vaccine service. So that's sort of between the public and private working to provide something. And yeah, I think this is something we're not thinking about as much as we should, how this is working in practice. But unusually, it's just managed to happen this way.
I completely agree. I mean, I think you refer to a perpetual headache of public health administrators, how to deal with the lab data. You know, I've reports from the 1980s and 1990s of US public health administrators are constantly complaining about the fact that if you commercialize services and somebody decides to get tested in another state, they don't have access to that data. They don't get any of the reports going forward. They can't see whether that lab provider is adhering to the standards. So it might mean that somebody with highly infectious disease goes 500 meters from his home across a state line to a private testing lab, but the actual public health authority has no idea what's going on, and then is a month later informed by Atlanta that something is happening in their area. So this data integration aspect is a huge challenge when it comes to the private service. And it's getting perhaps easier with the genomic data because there's less culturing involved, and so the IT systems are easier. It does raise a lot of privacy issues about what's going to happen with your data in the long term going forward. In many ways, I think the watershed moment for this wasn't COVID. I think the watershed moment for this was really 2009 swine flu in the US, where for the first time, they rolled out really successfully kind of a platform testing kit. So swine flu was the first time really PCR became a dominant way of testing the population for a highly contagious pathogen, which was spreading in a way that couldn't be stamped out or controlled at borders. And what the CDC did at that time, it was lauded all around the world and copied, was that it essentially created a recipe book for private test providers to emulate. So if you follow this way of testing, you can integrate your database into our database, and thereby we provide surge capacity, you get your profit, and the public is protected with our ability to survey this disease spreading. And that was so successful at the time that I think it almost created a kind of complacency after 2009 for, you know, because everything was being thought of in terms of the next pandemic, in terms of flu, right? That we could just re-pivot to that moment and provide the surge capacity with the help of PCR and private diagnostic providers, while obviously ignoring the fact that during this time, public health budgets across the world were continuing to be pared back and thus actually hollowing out pandemic preparedness capacity.
So I guess then that brings up a natural question. Number one, why doesn't the public, or even me, for example, hear more about 2009 swine flu as an important moment? Is it because, as you say, this is so successful that when you have success, no one cares? And I guess from a follow-on point, you've also mentioned that even though it was successful, it didn't change the underlying structural privatization, you know, ideas. So do any big events, contingent events, change the structure of what's happening when it comes to these public health labs in your mind?
I think that's a really important question going forward in terms of how we structure public health systems, because I think there's an inherent tension in public health, and perhaps it's something I should have mentioned earlier with the centralization and decentralization point, and that is, for what is public health good? Is it good for the emergency, or is it good also outside of the emergency for normal routine testing provision and normal routine service provision? And I think we've been sold in many ways a very attractive narrative of disease detectives, right? You know, people working with big data in big centers, modeling the next disease, modeling the next pandemic. If you look at the visualization of, you know, the WHO Pandemic Preparedness Center, it's all about people at computers with global information streams coming to them. You'll get similar visualization from ECDC or, you know, the British systems. And that's a very attractive narrative because it seems streamlined and rational, right? There are people who collect data, who rationally analyze the data, make sense of it, and devise the best possible response to an emergency situation. The problem with that is it allows you to strip back, while you're believing in this vision, the baseline service provision that allows you to compensate for messiness when things go wrong. And I think what we've seen with COVID is, with science evolving constantly, the virus evolving constantly, the need to have a kind of robust system in place that is able to adapt, that has a surplus capacity to throw resources at unexpected avenues, that has gone away in the sense by us throwing too much resources at this vision of centralized command and infectious disease control. And I mean, the Global North is, I think, now waking up to this vision, which, for example, African countries have been pointing out to us for ages, that this command and control style of infection control does not work in settings where environmental conditions may be overwhelming, unexpected, where they are under-resourced at the local level. And I think we're waking up to the fact that this vision that we've been exporting to these countries of, you know, boots on the ground, parachuting in through epidemic intelligence, may not be the most sustainable way of building long-term public health capacity or even providing routine testing services. In the US, many states actually do not provide anymore the routine testing services that they're legally required to for their population.
It's worth also mentioning swine flu was probably not that helpful for pandemic response. And because of the political fallout from investing quite heavily and the predictions of it being possibly worse than it was, did lead to cutbacks in having PPE, having the testing capacity, and also masks and, you know, simple things that are in a pandemic response for a country that we would normally have on hold. And yeah, swine flu did have that effect of cutting back on those provisions.
I completely agree. I mean, you know, in many ways, I think our learning experience with COVID is to expect the unexpected. And I think we were expecting too much of a rational ability to control an emergency, which by definition has elements which are beyond our control. And I think in the UK specifically, there was just no capacity on the ground to pivot at a time when the models were showing that the initial response was failing. And I think very similar in the CDC, I mean, we haven't talked about another really important thing, which is the autonomy of a public health system too, to resist, for example, the political imposition of versions of how a disease should play out, right? I mean, the interference of the Trump administration or, for example, the Johnson government also obviously hampered the ability of public health systems to respond in the initial moments. And I think these are things that, as a historian and as a social scientist, need to be highlighted moving forward. I think the recipe can't be that we need more of the same after COVID. I think what we need is to reorientate ourselves and to really ask ourselves why all of these preparedness plans and predictions that we had with the global health surveys predicting, you know, the US and the UK as the best prepared countries, why they were so wrong going into this. And unfortunately, I think we aren't necessarily having these conversations because we're still talking to the same group of people who believed in these models and I think are now involved in a sense-making process without necessarily consulting with a broader group of social scientists who will help in the sense-making.
So maybe as a follow-up to this, I might want to ask, which countries were more successful? I mean, which countries did the public health infrastructure did cope with COVID much better than expected, right? Because I do remember actually some of these infographics continued to come out after COVID started, showing, as you said, the United States and the UK being like at the top of the list. Whereas in reality, it obviously seemed so different than those rankings of preparedness. So what countries were positive surprises and maybe why were they more successful than we, broadly speaking, anticipated?
We probably have to think about pre-vaccines and post-vaccines, because we have witnessed particularly countries in Asia and the Western Pacific doing really well at the beginning of COVID, and some of the confinement policies as well, they were very effective. But now that we have vaccines, we're seeing, say, China, for instance, is not really doing as well as they were before. And it's a question of how they're going to change post-vaccines.
I would agree. I mean, I think the key message at the beginning of the pandemic was, right, there's a message of test, 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 you know, confined, test, 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 build the rapid ability to just do classic public health by isolating infectious disease and controlling a pandemic. And I think the countries that did well there were the ones that had the baseline capacity, obviously, to test, test, test. But it wasn't just that, it was their ability to tie the testing data into effective local community-rooted public health work, where people could trust the public health response. And this is why you had, for example, countries like Vietnam, which aren't massively resourced countries, do extremely well with a very present public health system at the local level. Obviously, different countries in that region have very different political and economic and cultural systems, but I think common to all of them was very effective and clear messaging from the public health body and a high degree of trust in the public health system and in the state. So to comply with the new rules that were coming out. Whereas I think lots of the Western responses were botched because of political factors coming in. I noted the administrations in charge at the beginning of the pandemic with inquiries that will inevitably happen, I think, over the coming years, looking into that in more detail. And I think that the other kind of big factor was obviously the fact that in this test, test, test phase, the virus we were dealing with was also very different biologically, right? I think the Chinese response at the moment is faltering, not just because of vaccination, but also because the virus itself is so much more contagious with the variants that we're dealing with now than what was happening initially. So I guess, once again, a multi-layered answer, but I think the countries that did well seem to have a solid hinterland of public health and a high degree of trust in the public health authorities, who are also effective at messaging.
I ask you, Samantha, because you're doing a project on vaccines and vaccine trials and talking to the people doing it, and you brought that up just a minute ago. I mean, from what I remember about public perception, you know, from 2020, such as I remember anything, maybe a little more than Lee blacking out for 6 months, but you know, there was this great wave of, you know, we just got to wait for the vaccines. Once we all get the vaccines, you know, we all go out and party kind of deal. And so how has that shaped, you know, the broader public perception of public health or, you know, ideas about vaccines, both before and after this moment of, you know, quote unquote triumph that now in retrospect seems far less triumphant?
It's really emphasized that vaccines alone can't solve a pandemic. Even if there was a vaccine that was strong enough to stop transmission, it's going to involve a lot more than just getting vaccines into arms. And that, on the face of it, is already an issue that needs to be addressed. But there are other public health interventions that we need to consider, and also having a vaccine that needs to be continually updated, having new variants. It's just not an end game solution to have a vaccine for COVID. And this is not within a usual public understanding of vaccines. And that's something that people have had to adapt to. And something that I heard quite a lot after people got their first and second vaccines were, oh, well, I'm vaccinated, I don't need to test. Yeah, I'm protected and I don't need to think about other health interventions as well. So I think it's an ongoing readjustment of the public's understanding about vaccines and the role that vaccines are playing within this particular epidemic.
Is one of Merle and my side projects, we look at popular culture, so specifically about the things such as movies, where the development of a vaccine tends to be kind of like the happy ending of, and either contagion or outbreak, right? You just like get the vaccine and everything sounds much better. And based on your understanding, I mean, how much do these things actually matter? Do these popular cultural narratives affect popular understandings of vaccines and their roles, maybe even more or less than official communications and so on?
I think also there's a fear from the public health angle that being honest about what a vaccine does and what the limitations are could put people off wanting to get vaccinated. And I think this has been a theme with all of the communication during the pandemic, that changing tack on our policies for controlling this virus will confuse people. But I think we need to acknowledge that we don't always have all the information and we might want to change our policies. So probably being honest and open with the public and having their understanding from that perspective that the situation changes should help increase trust between the public and the health authorities.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it's super interesting to reflect on follow the science, which everybody was reflecting, you know, repeating mantra-like right at the beginning. I wonder whether it would have been better to just say follow the data rather than assume a monolithic voice of science, a monolithic kind of output of science. I think historians of vaccines have been highlighting this for a long time, right? You know, that there's this idea of a vaccine in the public mind, but actually the vaccine technologies and the pathogens we're dealing with are vastly different and achieve different things. And the reason different groups have them are also different across the world. So, I mean, Sam's work goes into this in a lot more granularity. But I think for me, this is the kind of biggest learning moment, having attended public health conferences both before the pandemic and after the pandemic, is that this trust in, you know, the heroic pandemic experts riding in with the science and solving everything, it was also ingrained in the scientific community, I think, to a certain extent. And I think, how should I say, like weaning oneself off that image, which is also good to generate resources and trust, right? You know, you trust the CDC, and admitting that the CDC can make errors, I think, is a very important thing to build resilience, actually, and to rebuild public trust in messaging. In Ireland, a huge debate was the mask thing, where advice on masking changed. How can the science change? Can't the scientists agree on this? So yeah, I think that I'm picking all of this, not just from the perspective of COVID, perhaps also from the Ebola response and earlier responses in different cultural contexts, would be super interesting, I think, for future work in the area.
If we follow up on that, how would you understand or maybe characterize the CDC's response to COVID, broadly speaking, over the past 2 years? So what have been the trends within that response?
I would say that what we've just seen are kind of the broad-brushed approaches to COVID. And I think the initial approach was really interesting with the decision of the CDC to develop its own test and not to rely on the ones that were published. And as a consequence, the delay in response time. And at the same time, the struggle of the CDC, which had just had an announcement that its budget would be further cut by the Trump administration, to navigate creating sufficient anxiety about a pandemic without jeopardizing its chances to be heard within the Trump administration, the failure of this approach in the initial response phase. I think there are so many different factors at play with the new administration, with the choice of the expert they decided to put at the head of the CDC, that I would struggle to untangle that in complete detail. What I would say is that for the CDC, this seems to have been a profound learning experience in reevaluating the narrative in which it had come to believe, I think, in the 1990s and 2000s, that it was the best in the world, and that its data was supreme and that its technological capabilities outmatched those of other countries. And I think this shock in 2020 that other countries were outperforming the American system, not just in terms of confinements, but also in terms of testing capabilities, et cetera, has led to a rethinking in the CDC, hopefully, about how to go forward.
But I think it's even more than that, right? Because I mean, off the top of my head, I would imagine, maybe you can correct me here, but I would imagine that public health in the United States is probably very well funded compared to other countries. But on the other hand, the results of all this funding, if you look at it from a lay person's perspective, the result of all this funding has not been a bit behind other countries. It's been extremely bad, right?
Yeah, I mean, the US always says it's the wealthiest country in the world and, you know, it's got the best funded of everything, etc. And on a case-by-case basis, with individual examples, I think those stats hold true. But if I actually look at coverage across the US, in states like Alabama or Arkansas, you will not have the best public health coverage across the world. You'll find smaller states like Israel actually expending much more per capita on public health services. And it really depends on the vision a state has for what its duties are vis-a-vis the health of the public. In terms of public health laboratory coverage, the US certainly does not have the best public health laboratory coverage in the world. Now, that's my expertise, so I can speak the most to that. If it comes to public health services, which it offers the population in terms of freely accessible healthcare services to screen and treat, it certainly isn't outperforming the rest of the world. It has these centers of excellence, which are extremely well funded and belong to the world best. Whether they are the best, I actually don't know. I think that that really depends on the expertise and the kind of heritage and the networks these broad institutions are plugged into. One thing that the US certainly didn't have, for example, in this pandemic, was also isolation capacities within hospitals. The US hospital system didn't have enough beds to isolate infectious patients from other patients going forward. The UK didn't have that either, to paring back. And some of the other countries we're comparing the US and the UK with at the moment still had that from earlier phases of public health conceptualization. So this may be heretic, and I'm sure there will be plenty of economists who correct me, but I think it would be healthy to stop just saying we've got the best funded, et cetera, per world. If we break that down per capita and we actually look at a granular level of public healthcare across the US, I think we will see pockets of deprivation and underserved areas that are not world beating, if I may put it like that.
Well, I just want to chime in as the only American to say what it sounds like you're actually describing is much of the American, not just healthcare system, but the American system in general, which is to say, if you have access or the ability to access resources, it can be, you know, at the top of the list. But if you don't have access to that, then it can be deeply problematic. And the example I gave somewhat flippantly earlier on of how to get my kids tested is, you know, one example, right? I mean, I can get an 8 or 9 hour PCR test for my kids, but there's no way in which I would have known that if we hadn't found out from another family friend who had done that and also tipped us off that, oh, by the way, if you bring your kid in, you yourself can get that 8 hour PCR test. And so that's basically been the workaround for us to get a super fast PCR turnaround. But it's not as if that's advertised. And the only advertising you see is for the general state of Maryland ones, which are 1, 2, even 3 day PCR tests, which are essentially irrelevant if you want to actually isolate, find out if you have the virus. So I completely agree in that sense of how the American system, if it is a system, which I don't think it is anyways, works or doesn't work. So something you guys both just discussed, I wanted to kind of ask one last question about, which is how do you communicate better or at all these ideas that you shouldn't just get these big centers together, aggregate massive amounts of data, and that's going to resolve all your problems, right? That you actually need to rebuild local infrastructure, local testing capacity, and, you know, maybe include human behavior, social factors, economic factors in any of the data you're running, not just how many people are sick, how many people are recovered, et cetera.
I actually hope so. We're probably going to see quite a few public inquiries into the handling of COVID. And perhaps as part of that, there could be public consultation about how to make changes to the system and have a really, really big debate about what improvements need to be made. That's something that I would really like to see happen and involve the public, especially now we all have a much higher understanding of these issues. I think the general understanding of what a trial is and what testing means and so on has really been raised through the pandemic, unfortunately. But that's the reason why to involve the public in these discussions for preparing for the next pandemic.
One of the most helpful experiences I've had in my academic career was when Sam and the boss we were both working for at the time, Andy Pollard, in one meeting accused me of arm waving when I used the words discourse, power, injustice, inequality, etc. And it was really about breaking it down after having worked with Sam for 5 years in a very interdisciplinary setting with natural scientists, the ability to understand that these words don't mean anything to people outside of the humanities who've been drilled to understand them. And that what really works is when you're communicating is that you look at the terms they're using and together with them, you unpick them historically. So you create an empirical trail of crumbs for them to see that these ready, quick fix solutions are actually much more complex historically to implement. And that resulted in a lot of frustration in these meetings where, you know, I was always the guy saying, well, actually, in this context, this intervention didn't work, or, you know, this was the right intervention in another context. But I think over time, it helped us build a culture of embracing complexity. And I think with Sam's work also on vaccine hesitancy, I think what we're seeing is that many of these communities that were traditionally just bellowing, follow the science, are much more attuned to the fact they are in a very complex world of social factors. And in the antibiotics world, for example, with antibiotic innovation, that's led to a lot of outreach, actually, to social scientists and historians. I don't think the situation is particularly grim. I think what we need to do is improve as humanities scholars our ability to speak in the language of science without compromising the messages that we have, but perhaps avoid these kind of big 1970s theory hitters when we start engaging the community. And most of the time, they're surprisingly open and extremely willing to be intellectually flexible.
And I should say, now I believe everything Klaas says, because as a historian, he did see the danger coming way before our medical colleagues. And he was the one flagging to me, oh, actually, I think there's a problem here. Are you sure we should be taking this trip to Bangladesh in January?
And that wasn't me, that was Twitter. It was just me following the right people.
But now I believe the historians, if there's a pandemic coming and anyone's questioning whether this is the real thing, I'm going to ask Klaas and the others first, before the medical scientists, who were not worried at all.
No. The moment I got nervous was at that conference when they started flying out the public health experts, and we were the ones left.
That's true.
So what I'm hearing is basically, for all decisions, we should remove the public health experts and the economists and put all the historians at the table for our prediction abilities.
Not at all. Not at all. I think what we should have is people talking through future predictions with historians who have a knowledge of past failures. And I think that will create a degree of humility in our ability to predict stuff that I think is helpful going forward.
I mean, it's interesting that you highlighted the past failures rather than past successes, right? Because we are, I mean, as historians, I'll speak for myself, right? So as a historian, I work on, broadly speaking, the fall or transformation of the Roman Empire in late antiquity. So let's say 400 to 700 CCE. And over there, we're much more attuned, I think, towards crises, right? Crises, collapses, declines, failures. And the discourse over there is that we actually need to pay much more attention to successes and change the way we think about things that way. Whereas you're saying that we should highlight the past failures in particular.
I think it depends on the community you're speaking to, but I would say there's a deep truth in Karen Ruhleder's and Susan A. Starr's work on infrastructures, that we're tuned to seeing bigger infrastructures at play at moments of crisis, right? When all of the forces are on the table in a moment of failure. Whereas a success, I think it's easier to build simplistic narratives of this was the recipe and to blend out broader, more structural factors going into it. Sam and I have been working a lot on typhoid. And when we were digging into 19th century Oxford for one of our exhibitions, you know, on the need to relativize Northern claims of a great sanitary awakening, what we were really struck by was just the chaos and confusion that was underpinning the success going forward. So I think it is easier to focus on failures because more cards are on the table for us to see. And so as a consequence, there is a slight bias, obviously, of us being the pessimists at the table. But I think when you're dealing with communities whose sales force in the policy community is based on the ability of models to predict and to kind of contain risk at every single side, I think our duty to show that risk is essentially uncontainable, that you have to have capacity to expect the unexpected. That is an important voice, and that's missing at the moment. So I do appreciate the fact that we do focus more on failure than success. But I think we needed that focus on failure more before 2020 than we had it at the table.
It might be because public health has been the major success story of the 20th and 21st century. So in a way, we don't hear about the failures as much as we should, especially in hiring countries where we don't discuss how we reach the positions we're in now until we have something like COVID.
Do you guys have any questions for us?
Yeah, I mean, you know, thinking about Rome and how infectious disease narratives are so embedded, you know, especially with the recent very controversial Karl Harper publication on the fate of Rome. To phrase it well, ancient historians are so good at dealing with massive timescapes with not a huge amount of granularity of data, you know, crafting big narratives, bringing in environmental factors. What is the ancient historian's perspective on COVID? I mean, are we too granular in our focus on COVID as one event? Should we be zooming out and analyzing this in a kind of broader concept of climate change? Or, you know, are we contemporary historians too focused on, you know, the 5 to 10 year frame?
My answer to this would be that it's not where the discourse is. The way I understand my field, broadly speaking, is that we would like to have, so to speak, a seat at the table. We would like to be heard. We think we have something to contribute, even if that something is not always very explicitly or well-defined. But as far as I understand, we refrain from being too specific about how to consider COVID, right? It's more of, oh, we can learn from the past. But again, that's part of the discourse, right? It's just saying that the past is important. For whatever reason, right? There's like a list of reasons why you can say the past is important. But maybe Merle has a different take on this, but I haven't seen arguments of, let's say something like, okay, let's look at things more holistically, right? Let's look at COVID more holistically. Definitely not coming out of broadly speaking, ancient or medieval historian community.
So I think to answer your question actually quite specifically, I think we have a lot of difficulty for source data reasons to look at narrow windows, right? So 2, 3, 4, 5 years, let's just say. And so it's a lot easier to make 20, 30, 40 year claims on these things. And that offers both a positive and a negative. The negative is, you know, we end up looking at things much more in terms of state structures, right? So I would make the suggestion that no states that I can think of collapsed because of large pandemics, right? I mean, you can make statements about 100 years later, something happens or, you know, it weakens a state or whatever, but it doesn't really seem to, in the narrow window that you and I or all four of us are living through 2 years of COVID right now, you can't say anything changes for us. And really what we're looking at is state structures, which as a human being living through COVID, I don't really care to an extent, right? So long as the United States itself is not going to collapse, which I don't think it's going to collapse because of COVID, that's about the level of granularity you're dealing with. And I don't know what that offers to anyone aside from saying, well, you know, your state's going to keep going. All your friends might die, but you're fine. So I would say that's kind of the problem in terms of scale we're looking at. Now, the positive is obviously the flip side of that argument, which is to say, you know, even in situations in which the death toll might be significantly higher than COVID, the place you're living in, the community you're living in will go on as before and will be resilient, whatever you want to take that to mean. And all of you will basically be fine, relatively speaking, even if all your friends might die. So in that sense, there's both a positive and a negative message there that you can take, which is we're all, by that I mean as a global population, because of COVID, I don't think we're all going to die. I could be wrong, but that seems to be a decent prediction. And at the same time, what I ultimately do want to know more of vis-a-vis COVID is what we can take from it to make our world a better place. And that I don't think we can get from ancient pandemics to an extent.
I wondered if I could ask, and I hope this isn't too like off topic, about the podcast and what the main things you've gotten out of it and taken away. I'm sure people have asked similar sorts of questions before, but you've done quite a few. And I don't know, maybe it's hard to drill it down to particular things, but maybe things that are more surprising to you that you feel like you've got out of this process. Sorry, a bit of a sociologist type.
It's a good question, I think. Personally, for me, it was the realization that, depending on how you want to look at this, right? So disease, health, these academic communities are actually much more fractured than I expected. So even within history, there would be very different communities of people who would not know each other or not speak to each other. And we're part of this, right? This is part of the reasons why I like doing this podcast, is because I can, it's an excuse, right? It's an excuse to talk to people outside my narrow field of the same people going to the same conferences. And I think one of the conclusions that Merle and I have reached over the past 2 years is that we really need more of this. We really need more of these fora that bring people who don't necessarily speak together all that frequently and learn from each other, right? I mean, the interdisciplinary type of research is something that is very easy to say, and it's very attractive to say as well, but it's very difficult to do well. And the podcast has showed me how many different ways of doing interdisciplinary work there is. And again, how disconnected many of these communities are. That'd be my answer.
Yeah, I think I would start by echoing Lee's comment that, you know, we started this as historians of disease, which I don't think is an actual subfield that really exists, right? I mean, it's a subfield of history of medicine usually, but having had many historians of medicine on this podcast, we've learned a lot about that field. And as pre-modern historians, that's a different subfield of history of medicine. So as Lee said, I think all these groups are extremely fractured, are not talking to each other, even if they're working on very, very similar topics. I mean, we've done 90 podcasts now at this point. And, you know, someone like you guys working on, say, 20th century public health, let's just call it that, broadly construed as we talked about today, are actually working, as Klaus's question to us about ancient history asked us, on very similar questions to us, right? I mean, you're trying to figure out how do people live, experience disease, pandemics, this type of stuff, different types of sources, different type of data. But I think you do have a bit to share and work with each other. But, you know, we're ancient or medieval or Byzantine historians, whatever Lee calls himself these days. And so we'll never go to a conference, right, that you guys go to, you know, and we would never meet except through this. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing I'll say, which is why I asked you, Klaus, toward the end, and Samantha as well, is it seems to me the number one thing historians, and sorry, I'll be a historian for a minute, need to learn how to do is the communications aspect, you know, both the outreach and the ability to do press stuff. Because, you know, and that's why I've asked about getting a seat at the table, and I made my joke about economists and removing them. But this is something that's pretty clear from, you know, I would say a year and a half ago, is I think historians, as you put it, right, we like to wave our arms and complain a lot, but we don't even know how usually to approach becoming part of the conversation. It's not that we don't know how, it's that we don't even know how to approach it.
Would you say that's changing though, with the new sources that we are accessing? Over the past 10 years, I've read a couple of really transformative essays. Some of them come from ancient history. Some of them come from medieval history. Monica Green's work for me was hugely influential with just bringing biology back into history, understanding how pathogens work, working with archaeologists. And in my own work on the current project I'm currently doing, is it's all about understanding how these lab networks go global, but also how the microbial ecosystem changes in the 20th century with the antibiotic era, right? You know, what a huge genomic impact humans have had in the last 70, 80 years on everything around us. If you touch a table in front of you, you'll be dealing with a microbe in whose genetic information our culture is embedded. You know, our culture of medicine use, our culture of heavy metal extraction, all of these things. And I think historians, the ones at least I'm working with, are becoming better at unpicking this data. And just by becoming more literate with this data, we're becoming better at speaking to communities outside of our subfields. So I'm a bit more optimistic about the fragmentation aspect of it, because I'm learning a huge amount at the moment from reading ancient historians, people working with ADNA, just engaging with this, because I think it does open up with this new source genre discussions that were impossible to have 10 to 20 years ago.
I do agree on one level in terms of people using similar sources. The one thing, as I would say to respond, is how are the people who know how to use those sources, the biologists, those type of people, are they reading historical works at the same time? Or are we replicating, as often with this ancient DNA work, not on diseases, but on other work, you know, migration stuff, really old historical stuff that's been thoroughly shown to be deeply problematic, if not just wrong? And are we just regurgitating kind of 100-year-old arguments, and now the scientists have taken over and proven it? And so I think that there's a real need to work, I think, at an early stage to get this, you know, collaboration done. And you can't be writing this all yourself. So I think that's a good place to bring this conversation to a close. And I just wanted to thank you both so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
So I very much enjoyed that discussion because it was super wide ranging and really covered a lot of time and space. And one thing that seems pretty clear to me, based on the discussions of public health laboratories, is a lot of the changes that are happening there are changes that are happening across other structures in other aspects of American and UK life. But it was interesting to hear how specific events did or didn't change that trajectory, such as the 2009 swine flu or obviously COVID.
What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, the differences in obviously privatization and to an extent centralization that were happening, right? The discussion of lighthouse laboratories, right? And how that worked as a quote unquote solution that didn't often work in local communities. And just the, I would say, Lee, aggregation of quote unquote big data as a solution to all the problems, right? You know, people sitting there, as I think Klaus pointed out, you know, typing furiously at computers, that somehow those people were going to solve all the local problems that are often quite difficult to contextualize in a very local human perspective, I would say.
Yeah, I could tell Merle that when he was talking about that, you're probably kind of like smiling inside and saying, yay, kind of being happy about all that. But I think that more broadly, for me, the entire collaboration or maybe integration between the public and private sectors with regard to public health, more broadly speaking, I thought the discussion that we've had, or maybe even more the knowledge that they had, was far more nuanced than any public discussion I've been hearing about, really. So in most public discussions, it's more of a question of which one is better or where should we be aiming. But I think that as Klaus and Sam pointed out, there's actually much more nuance here that we need to consider, really.
Yeah, I thought their answer to my provocative question, I was clearly playing devil's advocate about, you know, privatization in some sectors being quote unquote better, they neatly responded to, which to say that, you know, it's not one or the other, but how they work together to increase or decrease surge capacity or to make things more possible was obviously a really good response in the sense of it's not just privatizing things is bad, right? Which is what people on the left would say, or, you know, public sector is bad, which is what people on the right would say. But that it's actually quite complex and nuanced when you get to each individual space on the ground, which actually reminded me quite a bit. And I almost said something during the interview to you, Lee, about that conversation we had with my friend AJ Herman about Kansas City and how all its multiple jurisdictions worked in terms of how public health could or couldn't work when it came to masking or vaccines within the city based on its particular location.
Yeah, and I think that one thing that all this discussion ties into, which actually was mentioned on multiple occasions within the interview, although it never really became the major part of this interview, were both the cultural and political factors that underlie these entire structures, right? So the political decisions, because of cultural reasons, over time, over decades, that end up shaping the public health laboratories, their work, their purview, and really their potential in solving, or maybe not really solving, some of the challenges that the broader state and society are encountering over time. So COVID specifically here.
Yeah, I thought that was a good point, right? I mean, it's not just that you go one way or the other, but you attempt to move the ship, so to speak, in little ways is perhaps a better way forward than attempting to completely reverse course or whatever other view of the ship you want to give.
Well, yeah, Merle, that's your take for a very long time. Although, to put it mildly, right, so big ships take a lot of time to turn around.
Yeah, hence slight course corrections are often more doable.
That's fair. Now, one other thing I liked about this interview is how Bas and Sam were able to really offer an external perspective on institutions and processes because they are, in a sense, outsiders, which I would have guessed would be much more difficult for people embedded within these systems to do, right? So they could give us a broad take, which would be easier for me to understand as a historian than I would say probably most people working within these systems who wouldn't look at things from such a broad perspective as they have.
Yeah, I think that's quite fair. I assumed you're also partially referring to the three of you bashing on the US from outside the US, which you guys seem to enjoy for that sort of a segment. And I almost piped in at the end, not with my actual take, but with a, you know, very pro-America patriotic slogan of some kind. And then I decided that I wouldn't do that.
I think for me, seeing the differences between, again, the discourse surrounding American institutions, for example, I mean, class referred to this, right, as this idea of America being the best, more or less everything. So seeing the discrepancy between this narrative, let's say, and reality has been enlightening, right? It's not something you would have expected before COVID, maybe not to this extent. So I feel it's important to call attention to these discrepancies and, again, learn from them, whether you're in the United States or outside the United States.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And hopefully within the United States, speaking for myself, we learn something from this to slightly shift the ship in terms of where it's going.
To move on maybe from here to before we wrap things up, so what have you been watching these days, Merle? Any new season of The Bachelorette or Mandalorian that our listeners should be aware of?
Well, actually, what I've been watching pretty religiously every week as it comes out is the show Winning Time on HBO. Do you know about this?
No. What's it about?
It's about the early 80s rise of the Lakers dynasty in terms of basketball. Are you aware of this situation at all?
Not really.
So it's about Magic Johnson when he arrives on the Lakers and kind of how the Lakers become a winning franchise for the next decade or so. And it's quite good, so I recommend it.
So Magic Johnson was a great player, right? But he was not a great player within the standard stats, right? He didn't score that many points, but he had like lots of assists, right? Or something like that.
Yeah, he was a point guard who was very tall, so he wasn't like a traditional point guard in that sense. So why I actually wanted to bring it up was an interesting thought about history, which is one of the people who's a main-ish character on the show plays the former player, former coach, general manager of the Lakers, Jerry West. And how he's portrayed on the show is a very hot-headed, angry guy, which by all accounts, factually, is not actually the case, what Jerry West was like. And this is done presumably to heighten the drama, to make it, you know, a TV show. And Jerry West has just sent a letter to the show asking that they basically like change his character and take it down because it's defamatory. And what's interesting about this from a historical point of view is, in a sense, you know, you think, well, this is a silly thing for Jerry West to do because he's just going to bring more attention to this. And that's true. But on another perspective, right, most people historically or personally will never know Jerry West. And so this image of what Jerry West is vis-a-vis this TV show that's dramatized facts will be the image of Jerry West that they'll probably now know forever, myself included to an extent. And so it just goes to show, I would say, the power of historical storytelling over quote-unquote facts in many instances.
Okay, I like how you reach these grand conclusions from those TV series, right? Right, the Winning Time, what's it called?
Yeah, Winning Time.
Winning Time.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good show. I highly recommend it. But as I say, this is why also I was talking to my dad the other day, and he said, why do you watch so much sports? And I said, well, actually, it's because sports is the one thing where I don't have my brain constantly just processing things like this, right? I mean, this is a show, an enjoyable show, a fun show about sports. Yet, what do? I still am thinking about meta-historical questions because of the show.
Well, I have the same role that you keep on using that excuse that it doesn't work, right? You said the same thing about The Bachelorette.
Well, The Bachelorette is also a show that's supposed to be silly and dumb, and I do overanalyze too. So it's only sports. This is why I watch a lot of sports. And I'd just like to say, this will be old by the time this episode comes out, but I did enjoy Arsenal beating Chelsea yesterday 4-2 at Stamford Bridge. But neither here nor there. What about you, Lee? What's happening? What are you watching?
Yeah, so two or 3 days ago, the last season of Better Call Saul started off. That's a prequel series to Breaking Bad. I mean, the previous season ended when we started recording this podcast 2 years ago, and it's now in the last season. I watched the first two episodes. I think they have to wrap everything up in 13 episodes, and there are a lot of loose ends to tie.
Fair enough. I think both of those shows were two shows that I never actually started watching.
Well, I don't think you can watch those shows without thinking more about them. So they're not like escapist shows in any way.
Sounds like I won't be watching anytime soon.
Fair enough. Okay, so at this point, we would like to thank our sponsors at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and Penn State University for funding this podcast. We'd also like to thank our great team, and our sound editor, Amitai Bar-Levi, and our webmaster, Meredith Reconnect.
Until next time, stay safe, get boosted if you can, and let us know what you think about meta-historical narratives in dramatic shows.